Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of A King's Ransom by James Grappando, narrated by George Guidel. This work is copyrighted 2001 by James Grappando. This recording is copyrighted 2001 by Recorded Books. Just 2 years out of law school, Nick Ray is on the career fast track at a hot Miami law firm when he suddenly plunged headfirst into a dangerous bid to save his father. Matthew Ray has been kidnapped while on business in Colombia's exotic port city of Cartagena, and the ransom is far more than the Ray family can ever hope to raise. And now, A King's Ransom.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Some called it a crown jewel. Others said it was a diamond in the rough, with the emphasis on rough. It was a matter of perspective whether Cartagena stood apart from the violence that besieged Colombia or was shrinking in its shadow. It was one of the Caribbean's most striking port cities, a special blend of colonial heritage, natural beauty, and salsa into the wee hours. The top attraction was the Old Town, a city within the city, surrounded by nearly 6 miles of impressive fortress walls that were built under 4 centuries of Spanish reign. There were smaller marvels, too, like cazuela de mariscos, a local seafood soup with chunks of cassava instead of potatoes. Deliciosa. The crowded beaches on the Boca Grande Peninsula weren't spectacular, but white sand and turquoise seas were close enough at Playa Blanca, or even better, Islas del Rosario. Throughout the city, colonial mansions painted in pastels and electric blue stood as reminders that the overall feeling here was decidedly tropical, in no small part Afro-Caribbean. Glorified by countless artists and writers over the centuries, Cartagena continued to evoke romantic sentiments as a unique place that, despite the influx of luxury condos, managed to retain the feel of old San Juan and Havana in its heyday. It was, after all, the official sister city to beautiful Coral Gables, Florida. Yet behind the exotic intrigue, beyond the hopeful hype of tourist agents, lurked an element of danger that was a fact of life in modern-day Colombia, especially for an American. Matthew Ray had visited Colombia before and was aware of the tragic headlines. 11 sport fishermen kidnapped on their boat off Barranquilla. Busloads of children commandeered on their way to school in Ocaña, north of Bogotá. More than 100 churchgoers taken at gunpoint in the middle of a Catholic mass in Cali. As a businessman, Matthew didn't deny the risks of a country besieged by 4 decades of civil war. As a fisherman, he savored the natural beauty, albeit from a half mile offshore. Matthew was in the commercial fishing business, which was big business indeed. He'd started his company in Miami with a rusted but trusted old lobster boat and a mountain of debt. 20 years later, he was part owner of Ray's Seafood Company with 40 boats and 2 processing plants in Nicaragua. With the United States importing more than 18 million pounds of edible fish weekly from Central and South America, he was always looking for new equipment, opportunities for expansion. It was that kind of thinking that had brought him to Colombia.
"Hector!"
he shouted. He got no reply. He tried again, louder.
"Hector!"
Hector Diaz was one of 6 Nicaraguan crewmen that Matthew had brought to Cartagena to overhaul 3 old shrimp boats and bring them back to the Mosquito Coast. They were the Niña, the Pinta, and the Coco Loco. It was just a hunch, but something told Matthew they weren't originally a set. All 3 were anchored side by side in the bay like a pontoon bridge, close enough together for the workers to step from one to the next. A noisy generator on the Pinta, the middle boat, powered the working lights and welding tools for all 3, making it impossible for Matthew to be heard from one boat to the next. He switched off the generator. The lights went out, the noise stopped. It was just past sunset, but the afterglow afforded just enough natural light for the men to see each other.
"You done fixing the head yet?"
asked Matthew. Hector had been working on the plumbing all afternoon. All but the marble tile and the color bidet, boss. He was a habitual wisecracker, but worth the trouble, as he and his son Levan could be trusted to sail just about anything from Punto A to Punto B, even three old shrimp boats. Hector was half Mosquito Indian, and in Matthew's book the mosquitoes were the greatest fishermen on earth. For centuries, their tribe had fished the Caribbean along Nicaragua's mosquito coast. Tall and lean, the mosquitoes were natural divers, and in his prime Hector had been a top lobster diver. His skills were legendary, like the story of the time he and Matthew got lost in a blinding storm at sea. Hector promptly jumped off the boat and dived down 35 feet for a good look around the reef. In a matter of minutes, he popped back up and told Matthew to turn the boat around and hold the course steady for about 3 hours. They sailed into port 2 hours and 45 minutes later. Only then did Matthew fully appreciate the way the mosquitoes knew their ocean, top and bottom, like their own backyard. Matthew smiled and shouted back, joking, "You're worthless, you know that? That's why I work for you, boss." Matthew snarled, but it was just a game they played. In truth, he envied Hector. Fishing had been a long tradition in the Diaz family, passed on from father to son for generations of mosquitoes. Matthew had a son, too, but not the same bond that Hector and Ivan shared. The sun was gone, the orange and purple afterglow fading. All along the rim of the bay, city lights emerged as twilight turned to darkness. Cartagena was coming to life. The parties would soon begin in earnest. The first time Matthew had visited the city, he'd ended up playing the accordion in some bar that boasted authentic vallenato music of the local Costeño people. He couldn't vouch for the music, but the 150 rum had delivered, as promised. That was 20 years ago. Cartagena had changed much since then. He'd changed, too. Coke instead of beer and rum, and his bladder wasn't what it used to be. Just one stinking soda, and already he had to break the proverbial pea seal. He started below decks, then stopped, startled by the shouting up top.
Manos arriba!
Hands up. It had come from the Niña, 2 boats away. Matthew climbed 2 rungs of the bridge ladder, just high enough to see over the clutter of the deck of the middle boat. Hector and Levan were face to face with 5 men with guns. On impulse, Matthew dived for cover behind a huge pile of shrimp nets. From there he could see 3 of his crew members on the Pinta standing on deck with their hands over their heads. The 4th was crouched down in the bridge, hiding, as yet unspotted by the guerrillas. He caught Matthew's eye and silently mouthed the word, "Guerrilleros." Matthew's heart pounded. For all his travels, he'd never actually laid eyes on armed guerrillas before. All wore ski masks, high leather army boots, and black leather gloves. Their green combat fatigues and bright red armbands were typical uniforms. One wore a cowboy hat that was flipped up on one side, Australian style, and a grenade attached to his belt. Matthew had heard that these bands of rebels were brazen enough to dress as the guerrillas that they were, never blending into the crowd with disguises, thriving on the publicity their group garnered from their very public crimes. They'd probably been watching the boats for hours, waiting for darkness so that they could pull up in silence and take the busy crew by surprise. That was the problem with noisy generators after sunset. If the crew was focused on work, an aircraft carrier could pull alongside them and no one would notice. From his hiding spot, and with the generator off, Matthew was close enough to hear Hector arguing with the men in Spanish 2 boats away. "Where's the American?" "No American here," said Hector. "We know he's here. You must have the wrong boats." "Who's that?" Matthew peered out from behind the nets. The guy doing the talking, the one wearing the hat, had focused on Levan.
"Julio Iglesias," said Hector.
"You think this is a joke? You don't want the boy. He's Nicaraguan, not American." "I said, who is he?"
"My son."
The guerrilla delivered a quick blow with the butt of his rifle. Levan's head jerked back, and then he stumbled backward and fell to the deck, his face bloodied. Hector rushed to him.
"Levan!"
The guerrilla stood over them, his tone louder and more threatening.
"Once more, where is the American?" "You broke his nose. And with the next shot, I kill him. Where is the American?"
Matthew had to do something, but what? 5 men with automatic weapons, and he was unarmed. Just then he caught sight of one of his workers on the Pinta, the one the guerrillas had not yet accounted for. He was crawling toward the rail, armed with a shotgun that was kept aboard for emergencies. Quietly, he took aim. Matthew sensed disaster. If the shotgun discharged, they'd all be killed. He had only one choice, reveal himself. He was sure they'd take the American alive and spare the others. "It's me you want," he shouted in English, but it was too late. The shotgun blasted. One of the guerrillas was hit, his chest exploding in red. His body dropped through the open hatch and into the hull. The other four immediately returned fire with fully automatic assault rifles. A barrage of bullets rained down on the Pinta, bits and pieces of the wood trim splintering into the air, the windows shattering. Paint cans exploded, ruptured cans of mineral spirits spilled onto the deck. One of the workers was bleeding from the head, his body motionless on the deck. The others leaped off the boat and into the harbor. It was all happening at once, but in Matthew's mind, the sequence seemed to unfold separately as if in slow motion. His panicked workers diving off the Pinta into the bay, the guerrillas scattering and firing wildly. And finally, in one cruel and senseless act, the tough guy in the Australian hat spraying the deck of the Niña with a shower of bullets. Dozens of crimson welts exploded across the bodies of Hector and Ivan. No! It crushed Matthew's spirit, as he knew instantly that his friends were dead. The guerrillas turned their guns toward Matthew, two boats away, but they didn't shoot. The three surviving crew members who'd abandoned ship were swimming away in the darkness, but the guerrillas didn't pursue them. They obviously wanted only Matthew, alive. The guy in the hat shouted, then the others shouted too. All five took aim and commanded him to surrender. No way, thought Matthew. Not to these murderers. Two guerrillas started toward him, cautiously crossing the middle boat on their way to Cocoloco. It was decision time. He could resist and surely end up dead. That wouldn't bring back Hector and his son. He saw only one way to avenge the murder of his friends. Live to fight another day.
Manos arriba!
Their leader shouted. Matthew took a long look, memorizing those cold black eyes behind the mask. He raised his hands to feign cooperation, then took one slow step back and suddenly tumbled over the rail. He splashed headfirst into the warm black waters below, holding his breath as long as he possibly could, fighting to stay down without air, swimming deeper and farther than ever before, knifing his way beneath the surface with long strokes and powerful kicks. He was diving like a mosquito, the way his good friend Hector had taught him, thinking only of escape. Chapter 2.
I was seated at the long, polished mahogany table in the main conference room on the 31st floor, ostensibly assisting my supervising partner in a morning settlement conference, in reality staring out the window at the cruise ships in the port of Miami while thinking about Jenna. More precisely, thinking about the last time I'd seen Jenna. It was a month ago today. We were engaged at the time. She'd invited me to take a long walk on the beach, said she'd meet me there. Any dolt could have seen what was coming, but I was so wrapped up in my own world and oblivious to our relationship that I'd actually shown up with a frisbee, a radio, and a bottle of wine. This was going to be one of those talks that wasn't really a talk, more of a speech with a few permissible interruptions. It was so over-rehearsed that Jenna had lost all her sense that it would hit me like a five iron between the eyes. The way she looked on that day would never leave my memory. The sad smile, her sandy blonde hair blowing in the gentle breeze, those big eyes that sparkled even in the most dismal of circumstances. I was speechless, the way I was the first time I'd ever laid eyes on her, only this time for far less enchanting reasons. The silence was insufferable once she'd finished, both of us waiting for me to move my lips and say something. Nothing came, and then it started to rain. At least I thought it was raining. I felt a drop on my head, and Jenna promptly lost it, right before my eyes. She was embarrassed to be laughing not at me, but at the absurdity of the situation, yet laughing nonetheless. It was then that I heard the shrill screech above me, saw the winged culprit swoop down from the sky in one last mocking pass. A seagull had shit squarely on my head.
This, of course, we took as an omen. I got my diamond ring back and hadn't seen her since. It wasn't a bitter breakup, but I surely would have understood a few hard feelings. We'd met 5 years ago as students at the University of Florida and had been virtually inseparable. She was from Tampa, hated Miami, and agreed to move here for me. I moved here for Coolidge, Harding, and Cash. With me working 60 and 70 hours a week in the Miami office of a Wall Street law firm, it was inevitable that someone with whom I was supposed to share the rest of my life would eventually ask, "What life?" "Can we try a different approach?" Duncan Fitz suggested. Duncan was my supervising attorney. I was at his side, as usual. Seated to his left was our client, a regional vice president from Medfam Pharmaceuticals. On the other side of the table was Tisha Williams, the plaintiff's counsel, along with her client, Gilbert Jones, an overweight former police officer who was now on permanent disability. 2 years ago, he'd been told to drop 30 pounds or retire from the force. He'd turned to a drug manufactured by Medfam. He lost the weight and, in the process, shaved about 30 years off his life. The drug had so damaged his heart that he needed a transplant that would never come, not with the inherent surgical complications presented by his weakened condition and obesity. His remaining time on this earth could be measured in months, perhaps weeks. He wheezed with each breath, walked only with the aid of a cane, and kept a portable tank of oxygen at his side for intermittent moments of extreme difficulty. It was hard not to feel sorry for him, something I didn't dare admit to Duncan.
"Try whatever approach you like," said Tisha, her tone less than amicable. "If this case doesn't settle today, we're going to trial."
Duncan smiled thinly and said, "Let's make a deal."
"I'm listening."
"That is my proposal. Let's make a deal, as in the old television game show from the 70s, you know, Monty Hall, Carol Merrill."
"Are you on drugs?" she said.
I was no longer thinking about Jenna. This was actually getting interesting. For 20 minutes, these two lawyers had been trading self-righteous speeches to impress their clients. I'd said nothing, which was exactly my job, watch and learn. That was the cool cash method of training its young lawyers, and Duncan Fitz was regarded as one of its best teachers. Duncan was a seasoned litigator whose two favorite forms of recreation were boxing with men half his age at the gym twice a week and, whenever possible, depriving an unprepared plaintiff's lawyer of a nice fat contingency fee. Duncan said, "Clearly we're at an impasse. Medfam has very generously offered to settle for $50,000. You want 10 times that amount.
20 if we go to trial.
Which will be a year from now. Then Medfam takes an appeal, which tacks on another year. By the time my client forks over a dime, Mr. Jones will be long since dead. The only winner will be his lawyer."
"How dare you," she said. "We're out of here. My client doesn't need to hear this."
"Yes, I do,"
said Gilbert. He spoke with a hint of a Caribbean accent, as he was Bahamian by birth. Tiny beads of sweat had gathered atop his shaven head, the dark, smooth skin glistening beneath the fluorescent lights. His gaze moved slowly from one person to the next, soulful eyes that bespoke resignation.
"Mr. Fitz, you're right, man. I don't have time to wait for trial, and I'm tired of standing on the sidelines while you lawyers yakety-yak-yak my precious time away."
Tisha sank back into her chair.
"All right, then. What's the offer?"
"I've been a litigator for 30 years, and I swear every time I step in front of the jury it's an adventure," said Duncan.
"Nature the beast. It's a roll of the dice."
"Precisely. So why not roll them now?" Duncan removed 3 documents from his briefcase and laid them on the table, one after the other, like playing cards dealt face up. "Medfam has executed 3 standard settlement agreements. The legalese in each is identical. Mr. Jones agrees to dismiss his lawsuit and forever release Medfam from any liability. In exchange, Medfam agrees to pay him a sum of money."
"How much?"
"Excellent question. As you can see, the amount payable is hidden by white adhesive tape. You want Gilbert to guess? That's where the game gets interesting. In one document, the hidden amount payable is zero. In another, it's the amount of Medfam's previous offer, $50,000. But in the third, we pay Gilbert Jones the full amount of his latest demand, $500,000.
This is preposterous. Let's go, Gilbert. Can't go, he said. My only chance is this. Reluctantly, she closed her briefcase. You don't settle a case this way.
Why not? Asked Duncan.
Because you just don't. For one thing, my client loses 2 out of 3.
He wins 2 out of 3, said Duncan. He loses only if he pulls up the zero, or if he listens to his lawyer and goes to trial.
There should at least be a fourth choice, the amount Gilbert would win if this case went to a jury.
It's my game, Counselor. Take it or leave it.
These be legal? Asked Gilbert.
Absolutely, said Duncan. Medfam has already signed all 3. Whichever one you sign, that's the deal.
Don't do it, said Tisha. Quiet, I'm trying to think.
Take your time, said Duncan.
Gilbert stared at the choices before him as if trying to see through the tape that hid the numbers. He licked his lips once, then again. His eyes darted from one document to the next. The thick creases in his brow grew deeper with concentration. I could tell that Duncan was enjoying himself. He was even starting to sound like a game show host.
What's it going to be, sir? Door number 1, door number 2, or door number 3?
Tisha said, As your lawyer, I strongly advise you to get up and walk right out of this room. They wouldn't ask you to play this game if they didn't know you were going to win at trial and win big.
But the man's right. I'd be dead by then. This be my only chance to see my money.
The room was silent. Duncan slid a cartridge pen across the table. Gilbert glanced at it, then locked eyes with Duncan. Finally, he looked at me. Why, I don't know. Perhaps he misconstrued my silence as impartiality. The expression chilled me, made me feel his desperation. This lawsuit was all this dying man had left in his life. His right hand shook as he grasped the pen. He stared at the first document and then at the second. The pen started toward the third, then stopped. He went back to the first one, signed on the blank line, and dropped the pen, mentally exhausted.
Lordy, lordy, Tisha said, groaning.
Without emotion, Duncan said,
Number 1 it is. Let's see what you could have won had you chosen document number 2. Nick, he told me, pull the tape.
I obliged.
50,000, said Duncan. Whoa, Nelly, that means Mr. Jones has either struck out completely or hit the jackpot. Let's have a look, shall we?
He nodded at me once more, again delegating the honors. I was beginning to feel like an unwilling accomplice, but I did as I was told and removed the tape. Gilbert froze. His lawyer was speechless. He'd chosen the zero.
Oh, I'm so sorry, said Duncan. If only you had trusted your first instinct and gone with number 3.
He removed the tape himself this time, as if throwing salt in the wound. It was really there, $500,000.
This is bullshit, Tisha shouted.
Only because you lost.
What are you hiding, Fitz? If you put $500,000 on the table, the case must be worth 10 times that much.
Right now, it's worth 0.
It's gambling. The agreement's illegal and unenforceable.
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but I truly hate to put your client through the ordeal of getting a court order to enforce a settlement agreement. So tell him there's 5 grand on the table and we all walk away happy.
The offer's good for 24 hours. After that, I move to enforce the deal.
You're bluffing.
Try me.
Duncan tucked the signed document into his coat pocket.
Nick will show you the way out.
With that, he gathered his papers and walked out the door with a delighted client. It was an awkward moment.
me left behind like the 6-foot fly on the wall in the aftermath of one of Duncan's client-pleasing stunts. I stepped away from the table and waited near the door, praying that Gilbert was not a violent man. But he didn't appear to be angry. He was stunned and silent, rocked by the loss of a $500,000 settlement.
"Hope you're proud of yourself," said Tisha.
I did a double take, realizing that she was talking to me.
"Tricking a dying man, playing on his desperation. You bastards are unbelievable."
I couldn't disagree, but I couldn't disown my own supervising partner either. I just wanted to let Mr. Jones know that this hadn't been my idea. "Is he going to be okay?"
"What do you think?" she said sharply.
My question was stupid, admittedly.
"Just leave," said Tisha. "We know our way out."
I left quietly, catching one last glimpse of Gilbert's stunned and pathetic expression. Had I not known what his case was really worth, Duncan's showboat tactics might not have disgusted me so, but I'd sat through the confidential strategy conferences. I'd heard the client privately admit responsibility for Mr. Jones's injuries. Medfam would have been getting off cheap, even if it had coughed up the $500,000 hidden behind door number 3. I'm not so pious as to refuse to represent anyone who shows up in my office wearing a black hat, but I had to draw the line at toying with a victim, destroying what little was left of his life, and then going back to Duncan's office to celebrate. Victories like this one made me wish I'd listened to my father and literally gone fishing the rest of my life. Dad would have liked that, but only if it had been my choice. Only if I'd truly shared my old man's love of the sea, the salty air, the squish-squish of fish guts beneath rubber boots. I couldn't deal with Duncan right then. I started back toward my office, then heard my name called as I crossed the main lobby.
"Nick Ray, caller holding."
It was a page from the operator which concerned me. The firm's policy was to refer unanswered calls to the voicemail system. Pages were only for true emergencies. I took the call at the phone bay off the main lobby. It was my mother, which only heightened my worries. Never did she bother me at work. She sounded awful. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"It's..." Her voice broke.
I could tell she'd been crying.
"Mom, what is it?"
"It's about your father."
My heart leaped to my throat. "Is he okay?"
"We don't know. He's missing."
"What do you mean, missing?"
"He may have been kidnapped."
"When?"
"Last night."
"Where?"
"On one of his boats in Cartagena."
"Columbia? What was he doing there?"
"No one seems to know anything for sure. It's all so confusing to me, the things I'm hearing."
"Who told you this?"
"I went numb when he called. I'm sorry, maybe you should call him back and speak to him directly."
"Who, Mom? Who did you talk to?"
"Oh, dear, I'm blanking out. Your father's business partner in Nicaragua."
She was getting more scattered by the minute. "Guillermo," I said.
"Yes, Guillermo. He was trying to be strong, but he sounded so worried."
Guillermo had survived Nicaragua's earthquakes, revolutions, and hurricanes. If he was worried, I was worried. But I didn't dare let Mom pick up on my concern.
"Don't be scared. Everything's going to be okay, I'm sure. Just come home, please. The FBI will be here any minute."
"Did you call them?"
"No, Guillermo did."
"That's good. Things are moving already."
"I need you here now. I can't do this by myself."
"I'm on my way." As I hung up, I noticed my hand shaking. A deep breath calmed my nerves. None of that in front of Mom, I told myself. Then I ran back to my office to grab my car keys. Chapter 3. Shortcuts saved about 20 minutes off my trip. I knew all the winding back streets, having logged thousands of miles as a kid on a bicycle in the area known as the Golden Triangle in Coral Gables. My parents still lived in the same colonial-style house on Toledo Street that the family had moved to when I was 8 and my sister was 5. It was all so familiar, with one exception: the unmarked vehicle parked in the driveway. It was a reality jolt, my first visual confirmation that Dad was really in trouble and that the FBI was truly involved. I parked my Jeep on the street and hurried up the sidewalk. Through the front window, I saw my mother seated on the edge of the living room couch. A man was seated in the armchair, his back to the window. I entered quickly without a knock, then halted in the foyer. My mother rose and we locked eyes. She said nothing, but the expression said it all. I went to her and held her. She was heavy in my arms, sobbing. Finally, she broke away to dab her eyes with a tissue.
"I'm sorry," she said with a sniffle. "I'm being so rude. Nick, this is Agent Lester Nettles from the FBI.
Nettles rose but didn't smile, almost too somber even for an occasion as serious as this one. He was well-groomed, handsome, very professional-looking. He struck me as the African-American version of the quintessential G-Man portrayed on those old television shows back when the FBI seemed to be comprised entirely of white ex-Marines. We shook hands, dispensing with the formalities as I got right to the point. "Is my father okay?" "We believe he's alive." "What happened?" He finished off the last swallow of coffee my mother had brought him, then continued, "It appears that 3 fishing boats belonging to your father's company were overtaken by force while in port in Colombia. 3 crew members were shot and killed. 3 others jumped in the harbor and swam for their lives. 1 is still missing. 2 have been recovered, the only witnesses so far." "Do any of them know what happened to my father?"
"No one's 100% sure. They all say that the gunmen seem to want to take your father alive, but there was a lot of gunfire exchanged."
"That doesn't mean he was hit. He could have escaped, right?" Nettles was slow to respond, too slow. My mother shuddered, realizing that there were only 2 realistic possibilities, neither of them pretty.
"For now," said Nettles, "we're assuming an abduction."
"Who is this we you keep referring to? Is the FBI doing an investigation?"
"No. The only information the FBI has so far is through intelligence bulletins from the State Department."
"That's not too reassuring. I just called the U.S. Embassy in Colombia on my way over here, and they weren't very forthcoming. I'm not sure what to make of that."
Nettles glanced at my mother, then at me. "You didn't hear this from me, okay? But the primary interest of the State Department is foreign policy. Most American families who go through this ordeal are surprised to find that the one government agency that puts the interests of the victim first is the FBI."
"Well, then, thank God you're here," said Mom.
Nettles seemed to enjoy the praise, but if we were going to get all kissy face, I decided to push for extra information, like the things the embassy had told me were for the government's eyes only. "At least now we have someone who can tell us what's in the State Department's intelligence bulletins."
"What do you want to know?" he asked cautiously.
"For starters, who took my father?"
"That's not clear yet. One of the attackers was killed in the skirmish. According to the local police, he was dressed as one of the guerrilla groups that operate in Colombia, combat fatigues, the whole getup. But it could also be someone who was trying to make it look like the work of guerrillas. We can't rule out common criminals or even one of the paramilitary organizations."
"Excuse me," Mom interrupted. "Are you saying my husband may have been kidnapped by the Colombian military?"
"Quite the opposite. The Colombian army has been at war with both right-wing and left-wing groups for years. The Marxists are the guerrillas. The right-wing is paramilitary."
"Why would they want my dad?"
"They don't. They want your money. You should expect a ransom demand to come by mail or international courier service very soon." I stepped toward the window, not quite believing this.
"You're saying that some Marxist group over 1,000 miles away killed half my dad's crew, kidnapped my dad, went to all this trouble just to squeeze a little money out of the Ray family from Carl Gables?"
"First of all, it won't be a little money. They usually have inflated ideas about the wealth of American families."
"How inflated?"
"It's best not to speculate about these things. Whatever the demand is, it's negotiable."
"Negotiable?" I said, almost scoffing. "We're talking about my dad, not a used car."
"Trust me, if you decide you have no choice but to pay a ransom, you still negotiate. It's sad, but kidnapping has turned into a big business worldwide, and in Colombia, it's literally out of control. 200 a month, at least."
"My God, it's like some kind of a mill."
"A money mill, to be exact. Hundreds of millions of dollars in ransom every year. These groups would like the world to think that they're politically motivated, but they're mostly thugs looking for money to bankroll drug labs and other criminal activity."
That last remark struck me, especially coming from an FBI agent.
So if we pay a ransom, we're dumping cash into some criminal's war chest. In a broad sense, yes.
And the FBI doesn't have a problem with that?
We're not thrilled about it. For years, we had a no-concessions policy in dealing with international kidnappers, but the more progressive view in the Bureau these days is that if the family wants to pay a ransom, we don't stand in their way.
What if we just can't come up with the money?
If you're asking whether the U.S. government will pay the ransom or even lend you the money, the answer is no.
So then what happens?
With a subtle arching of an eyebrow, he seemed to be signaling that it was best not to answer that question in front of my mother.
Stupid question, I said, backtracking. Of course we'll get the money, Mom asked. What happens next, Mr. Nettles?
There's a lot involved in an international kidnapping, said Nettles, not the least of which are jurisdictional issues between Colombia and the U.S., between the FBI and other U.S. agencies, between the Colombian police and the Colombian army. I think my mother and I are in agreement that we don't want to leave this up to anyone but the FBI.
That's right, said Mom.
I hate to inject a dirty word like politics into the equation, but certain matters of diplomacy must be resolved before the FBI can officially get involved.
What does that mean?
The bottom line is that the FBI's negotiators can't assist in a case outside the United States until the State Department invites us. As yet, we haven't been formally invited.
This isn't a wedding. What kind of invitation do you need?
It's not just a formality. The State Department has to respect local autonomy, and they have relationships with the host country that have to be maintained long after the resolution of this kidnapping. They don't just send in the FBI every time an American gets into trouble.
Is there something we can do? Mom asked.
Yes, he said. Make a list of who you know and call them. I hate to say it, but connections matter. The higher up, the better.
I don't have any connections, said Mom.
I'll work on that, I said. Good, said Nettles. I thought for a second, then backtracked. Except how am I going to be plying for contacts? Shouldn't I go to Colombia? My advice is no. You'll find yourself much more effective here trying to get your own government moving. You should send someone down to represent the family. Your lawyer, a friend of the family.
Guillermo, my mother said.
My father's business partner, I explained.
Mom said, he's going to be in Cartagena tonight. He has to check on the surviving crew members and make arrangements for the ones who passed away. And he's Nicaraguan. His Spanish is a lot better than yours, Nick.
That's perfect, said Nettles. I was a little reluctant. I didn't really know Guillermo, though it was true that he'd been my father's partner for over a decade. I glanced at Mom, however, and it was obvious that she didn't want me to leave her here to deal with the FBI and State Department by herself. Okay, I said, we'll let Guillermo handle things in Colombia. Nettles seemed to approve of the decision. He glanced toward the door as if it were time to leave. He dumped a ton of information on us, and he seemed experienced enough to know that the family needed time to digest it, time alone to grieve. Mom shook his hand and thanked him profusely. I saw him to the door and followed him outside. Level with me, I said as we reached his car in the driveway. If this is a kidnapping, and the kidnappers are some kind of guerrilla group, what are the chances of my father coming back alive?
Too early to say. There's so many variables.
You must have statistics of some sort.
Reliable numbers are hard to come by. The police, the army, the politicians, just about everybody in Colombia has a stake in making the situation seem better than it is.
All I want is a general idea, not an answer written in stone.
He hesitated, then answered, the most reliable numbers I have are from our legal attaché in Bogotá. 104 kidnap victims murdered from January to June of this year. But the violence can go in spurts, depending on how the war's going between the rebels and the Colombian army. If the guerrillas are trying to make a statement, you may see more kidnapping victims murdered.
How many more?
I don't know.
Come on, the family deserves to know the truth.
He seemed to be searching for a positive spin.
The truth is, worldwide, only about 9 or 10% of kidnapping victims are killed or die in captivity.
Only? I said.
The flip side is that there's a 90% chance of survival. Pretty good odds.
Oh, really? Think of the last 10 people you said hello to.
Now imagine one of them dead. How good do those odds sound to you now?
His expression fell as if he'd never thought of it quite that way.
We need the FBI on this case, I said. Let's get that State Department invitation.
He said nothing, but I knew what he was thinking. I needed to get to work on my list of connections. It was time for me to call on friends in high places. Now, I just had to figure out who the hell they were.
Chapter 4.
Faster than you can say, who do you know, I was back in my office, or more precisely, Duncan Fitz's office. Working as an associate in one of the largest law firms on earth certainly had its disadvantages. The lawyers who set my salary and measured my progress toward partnership knew me only from written annual review forms completed by the handful of partners in the Miami office. 98% of my colleagues were virtual strangers whom I would never meet, never even talk to on the telephone. They worked in different states, different countries, different time zones. Many spoke English as a second or even third language. When one of them was fired, or sometimes even when an entire office closed, I usually found out about it weeks after the fact, usually by happenstance, and then only by inference from the fact that an email I'd sent was returned as undeliverable. Cool cash could be an overwhelming, impersonal workplace. At the same time, it had a way of making the world seem very small. Duncan was in an exceptionally good mood, having just returned from a long celebration lunch at the City Club with his client from Medfam Pharmaceuticals. From the looks of his red nose, it appeared as though a few glasses had been raised to the health of the not-so-healthy Gilbert Jones.
"Sorry you didn't join us," said Duncan, seated behind his antique desk. "Where did you run off to?"
"Emergency. I got some distressing news." His grin completely vanished.
"Those bastards didn't call the judge, did they?"
"No, it's not about the Medfam case."
"Good.
It's about my father."
As a rule, Duncan didn't shift easily from work to personal issues, but he listened with concern as I told him everything I knew so far, the phone call from Mom, the meeting with the FBI agent. I didn't come right out and ask for any favors. That wasn't the way to operate with Duncan. I just made it clear that the FBI wouldn't get involved in the case without an invitation from the State Department and that political connections might expedite the process.
"Consider it done," said Duncan.
"You can help?
Can camels spit?"
I had to think about that one.
"We have a former Undersecretary of State working in our Washington office. I'll call him right now."
"That's fantastic. I can't believe it."
"Believe it," he said proudly. He leaned back in his leather chair and rested his hand atop the globe on his credenza. It was another antique, a distinctive but ugly piece with the oceans in black. He gave it a spin and asked, "What do you see here?"
"The world?" I said tentatively, sensing a trick question.
"Look closer. It's Coolidge, Harding, and Cash. We're everywhere, which is very good news for your father. This phone call I'm about to make is only the beginning."
"Thank you."
He opened his desk drawer, removed a 3-ring notebook, and handed it to me.
"Open it."
I thumbed through the first few pages. The book was filled with pictures and bios of influential people. Members of Congress, the U.S. Attorney General, even the President of Costa Rica. It went on for pages, at least 2 inches thick.
"What is this?" "It doesn't have an official name, but call it our A-list alumni registry. Everyone in that book has worked at this law firm in one of our offices around the world. If you think any of them might be able to help your father, you just let me know. All I ask is that you let me make the phone calls for you. Nobody's going to jump for a young associate in the Miami office, even if your father is kidnapped."
"Damn, Duncan. Maybe you aren't the heartless son of a bitch everybody says you are."
"Don't be so sure. It doesn't hurt to have the most promising young lawyer in Miami beholden to me for life."
He was half-smiling, but I knew Duncan well enough to know he was at least half-serious. Sure, I'd owe him big time if he could pull this off, and that was fine by me. Dad would have sold off his fleet to save me. At least, I liked to think so.
I moved to the edge of my seat as Duncan picked up the phone and dialed our Washington office. An hour later, I was at my mother's house trying to cheer her with a little good news. The wheels were in motion, I assured her, and I tried to put on my best face. I was fooling her no more than she was fooling me, the way she emerged from her bedroom every 45 minutes, trying to hide her red and puffy eyes, assuring me it was allergies. We sat down together at the kitchen table and made a list of people we should notify. Mom made the first few calls, but it was emotionally exhausting. I picked up where she left off, and soon the grapevine was in full swing. By mid-afternoon, our phone was ringing off the hook. Dad's friends, Mom's friends, friends of friends, people we hadn't heard from in years, all were offering to help in any way they could. Other than to keep Dad in their prayers, we didn't know what to tell them. This was all foreign to us. The only thing we knew was that by the end of the day, the one phone call we'd wanted had yet to come. There was still no word from the FBI or the State Department. I decided to stay with Mom that night, though my being there only seemed to highlight the fact that my sister wasn't. In a crisis like this, I suppose it was natural for Mom to want both of her children, even if she and her daughter weren't even technically on speaking terms. My parents had given me the right amount of freedom as a child, but Lindsay, they'd strangled, especially my mother. From preschool on, whatever Lindsay was doing, Mom was right there as room mother, assistant, soccer coach, teacher's aide, you name it. It was all out of love, surely, but Mom just couldn't seem to grasp that taking her eyes off her daughter for more than 5 consecutive minutes didn't constitute abandonment. A disastrous semester of homeschooling in the 8th grade made it almost inevitable that Lindsay would run with the wrong crowd in high school. And by her junior year, she was barely speaking to either parent. I became Lindsay's only lifeline to the family. Knowing that she was a bright kid, I talked her into going to college, though it was her own idea to enroll at the University of Puget Sound, near Seattle, farther away from home than any other school in the contiguous United States. She earned a degree in journalism, and for the past 2 years, she'd been traveling across the Americas in search of her first byline. Unlike my mother, I didn't see it as the end of the world that she wanted to go out and find herself. She never phoned our folks, and even her calls to me were pretty rare, maybe once every 6 weeks. I'd find out where she'd been, send her a little money, whatever she needed. For my parents' benefit, I'd subtly try to convince her that finding herself didn't necessarily mean losing her family. She didn't seem to be biting. Mom and I stayed up talking till after the 11 o'clock news, then said goodnight. My old room was virtually unchanged since the day I'd moved out to go to college, preserved like a time capsule. The dim light of the moon shone through the window, just bright enough to reveal an outline of my past. The Miami Dolphins team poster I'd worshipped as a teenager was still on the wall, hovering over the old dinosaur of a computer I'd used to explore everything from Super Mario Brothers to, well, dinosaurs. I half expected the door to open at any minute and my father to check on me the way he did when I was in high school. Spot checks were his way of keeping his teenage son from sneaking out at midnight to hang with the cool crowd in Coconut Grove. But as the minutes slowly passed, the house slipped deeper into an eerie silence. It seemed empty without Dad, and it made me ache inside. I wondered where he was sleeping tonight, if he was sleeping, if he was still alive. The phone rang at 12:30. My immediate hope was that they'd found Dad. My fear was that they'd found his body. It was FBI agent Nettles on the line, which put my heart directly into my throat. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "What is it?" "It's sort of an administrative issue. At this hour, I've just received confirmation that the Colombians are officially treating this case as an abduction, which is good news. That means they have reason to believe your father's still alive."
"Have they heard from the kidnappers?"
"No, but their divers have searched the area thoroughly. No body was found."
"No corpse. That was good news, I suppose. Will the FBI take the lead now that it's officially a kidnapping?"
"It's not legally a kidnapping until there's a demand for ransom. It's an abduction."
"We're still talking about a United States citizen. I'd like to see the FBI assert itself."
"That's the other reason for my call. I'm afraid that the FBI isn't going to intercede in this case."
I'd been pacing across the bedroom with the phone to my ear, but I suddenly stopped, cold in my tracks.
Come again?
He paused, as if measuring his words. As I explained to you and your mother earlier, the FBI can't get involved in cases of international abductions or kidnappings unless the State Department invites us.
That's being taken care of. The supervising partner at my law firm assured me that the State Department would extend an invitation within 24 hours.
That much has been done. They've extended an invitation.
Then what's the problem?
The FBI has declined it.
What?
The State Department placed certain conditions on the FBI's involvement that were out of line. It was impossible to accept their invitation.
What kind of conditions?
I'm not at liberty to elaborate.
Come on. You have to give me something.
I'm sorry, I can't.
Look, I'm not trying to put you in a bad spot. Let's set up a meeting with your supervisor first thing in the morning.
It won't do any good. This decision wasn't made in the Miami office.
I'll fly to Washington if I have to. Just give me the name of the person to talk to.
I don't have any specific names for you. I didn't understand it, but clearly I was being stonewalled, and it was making me angry.
So that's it. Too bad, so sad, see you later. That's totally unacceptable. At least tell me which door to knock on. Should I start with the FBI or the State Department?
I wouldn't go either of those routes if I were you.
Is that some kind of threat?
No. I'm trying to steer you in the right direction, so listen carefully to what I'm saying. If it was my father who was kidnapped, I wouldn't waste time trying to change the way the FBI and State Department think.
If your father was kidnapped, the FBI and State Department wouldn't be bogged down in political testosterone.
He fell silent, then replied in a noticeably softer tone, I wish I had better news for you. I mean that sincerely.
Just what my father needs, sincerity.
He bade me a hollow best of luck, and with the click in my ear, I had the unsettling sense that the whole FBI had just hung up on me. Me and my father.
Chapter 5.
It was my job to tell Grandma everything. Or not. Mom left it up to me to decide what a 78-year-old woman could stand to hear about her only child. I left the house at 9 a.m. It was an hour's drive, so I phoned Duncan on my cellular with an update. He was as baffled as I about the FBI's declination of the State Department's invitation to intervene in the case.
Those twits, he groused. Let me make another phone call.
Who are you going to call this time?
Whoever it takes. I've been concentrating only on the State Department so far, but sounds like it's time for a full court press. I'm sure we know someone who can get right to the FBI director.
I loved it when Duncan was fired up about something I needed done. I thanked him several times before hanging up. By 10 o'clock, I was in the upper keys, having driven slowly. I wasn't sure how to put a positive spin on this for Grandma, and part of me kept hoping that the whole conversation would be preempted by a sudden phone call from Mom, a miraculous message that Dad had somehow found his way to the U.S. Embassy unharmed. He'd been missing for almost 36 hours, however, and the possibility of his successful escape seemed less likely with each passing minute. Abduction was the only logical inference. Unless he was dead. Not in a million years would Grandma believe that her son had fallen at the hands of some deadbeat Colombian guerrillas. Her son was a fighter, a survivor like her. Grandma was a conch, a native of the Florida Keys. When she was 12 years old, her house was destroyed by the monster hurricane of 1935 that killed more than 400 people. The upper keys were ravaged, entire families were lost, a rescue train was washed into the sea. At least one fool braved the storm trying to save his fishing boat. Grandma found her father's body naked in the mangroves, his clothes ripped away by 200-mile-per-hour winds. 9 months later, she and her mother moved into one of 29 houses built by the Red Cross for the survivors who'd insisted on staying put and rebuilding their shattered lives. They were built for fishermen and farmers, plain folk who had lost everything. They were built to last, The frame, the walls, the roof are all poured concrete, 250 tons of it, reinforced by another 150,000 pounds of steel rods, all for a two-bedroom house that was a mere 600 square feet of living space. It was a bunker, virtually indestructible, symbolic of the Conch spirit. Grandma inherited the house when her mother died and made it her home as a young bride. That was the house my father had grown up in. It wasn't an easy life. I remembered seeing an old photo of my father as a young boy seated in the kitchen, each leg of the table resting in a tin can of kerosene to keep the cockroaches from climbing up and walking off with a family meal. Not that there was ever much food around the house. At the age of 6, my father became the man of the house. He loved the ocean, but hunger had really inspired him to fish. He caught them, Grandma cooked them. It was all they had and all they needed, each other and their Red Cross house. Together they'd survived the occasional hurricane and anything else the world could throw at them. Now, it was up to me to tell Grandma that her son was missing. "Get out!" she shouted. I was standing just inside the front door, hadn't even set foot inside the living room. It wasn't a case of killing the messenger. It was just one of her bad days. Grandma had Alzheimer's disease. She was seated on the couch watching Judge Judy on the tube, dressed casually in a cotton blouse and plaid Bermuda shorts. Her hair was done the way she'd always worn it, neatly cut with a hint of reddish tint. She looked just fine, and it pained me to see her act this way. For months, my parents had been trying to persuade her to move in with them, but she wouldn't budge from her concrete bungalow. A home care nurse helped her get by from day to day. "It's okay, it's only me. Don't you dare set foot in this house." The nurse interceded, "Now, don't be rude, Marion, it's family." I tried to make eye contact from across the room, hoping to establish a connection. Her expression was cold, though it wasn't an unknowing blank stare. She seemed to know me all right. She just didn't seem to like me very much. "I stopped by for a visit," I said.
"You pop in once a year. That's supposed to make everything okay?"
"It's okay if you don't remember, but I was here last month."
"Just go,"
she shouted, this time flinging an ashtray across the room. I ducked as it flew over my head, then shattered on the wall behind me. The nurse pulled me into the hall, out of Grandma's line of fire.
"It's not a good day for her."
"I didn't mean to bring this on."
"You didn't. Just try again some other time."
"Would it really make a difference?"
"You'd be amazed. The earlier in the day, the better. Before breakfast is best."
"I can come back tomorrow.
I'll call and let you know how she's doing before you drive all the way down."
I thanked her and started out the door.
"You bastard, Matthew! What kind of a son are you anyway?"
I looked at the nurse, almost speaking to myself. She thinks I'm my father?
She's terribly confused today, but truthfully, you two do look a lot alike. You even sound alike.
It wasn't the first time I'd heard that, but usually it was intended as a compliment. I had my dad's smile, my dad's good heart, whatever. No one, least of all his own mother, had ever mistaken me for my father, the bastard. Again, I thanked the home care nurse, then closed the door on my way out. As I cut across the front lawn to the pebble driveway, I tried to dismiss the outburst as irrational, knowing that the anger expressed by Alzheimer's patients toward loved ones was often baseless and imaginary. But it made me realize how windows to the past could close forever, whether by the slow onset of a disease or a sudden abduction. There were so many questions that I might never have the chance to ask my father now, not just about family matters, but about the separate life he'd built for himself in another part of the world. All those trips to Central and South America that had finally gotten him abducted. Or worse. I got in my Jeep and drove away, fearful that I'd forever feel the weight of conversations we'd never had. The drive up to Miami ended the same way the drive down had started, with a phone call to Duncan. His secretary said he was meeting with a new client and couldn't be interrupted. "Do you know if he spoke to anyone at the FBI or State Department this morning?"
"I'm sure he hasn't," she said. "This meeting has been going nonstop since you called."
A more encouraging end to the conversation would have been nice, but at Cool Cash, paying clients always come first. I was sure that Duncan would eventually make a few phone calls to try to break the deadlock that was keeping the FBI out of my father's case, but time was slipping away. I decided to call the embassy myself. My contact person at American Citizen Services in the consular section, William Ebersole. "Anything new?" I asked. "Nothing I'm aware of. I got an interesting call from the FBI last night. They tell me that the State Department invited them to work the case, but they declined. I'm not in a position to confirm or deny that. I was told that the reason they declined was that the State Department had placed unreasonable conditions on their involvement." I sensed he was fuming. Nettles had evidently related more details to me than the State Department had expected.
"Whoever told you that is mistaken," said Ebersole.
"Are you saying that there were no conditions?"
"No. The conditions were not unreasonable."
"What were they?"
"Very simple. The State Department welcomes the involvement of the FBI so long as the FBI agrees to refrain from taking any actions that are inconsistent with the U.S. government's long-standing policy on terrorism."
"What policy do you mean?"
"The same policy we have espoused for many years. In cases of international terrorism, American law enforcement personnel cannot play any role in negotiations with kidnappers that lead to the payment of ransom or other concessions in exchange for the release of hostages."
"Are you saying that if the kidnappers promise to kill my father unless we pay them a nickel, the official position of the U.S. government is to tell my family to start making the funeral arrangements?"
"That's not a very realistic example, nor is it productive for me to debate our policy with you. I can certainly understand how harsh this might seem to you or any other private citizen caught in this terrible situation, but the U.S. government does not give